be out of sight. It was a small glade, set about 20 metres inside the forest, below Castle Araluin. There was a clearing about 8 metres across, surrounded by thick-growing trees that would conceal it from anyone passing by. The trees would also provide shelter for her horse, in the event that the weather turned bad. Although Bumper was a hardy little animal and used to spending time in the open. Still, there was no need for him to be any more uncomfortable than he had to be, which was why she had asked to borrow a blanket for him. They reached the spot she had selected and she dismounted. She tethered Sundancer to a low-lying branch, and then led Bumper through the foliage that grew up between the trees, shoving the thicker branches to one side. The Eridan whinnied uncertainly as they disappeared into the trees, and she called to him. "I'll be back. Don't panic."
"Thoroughbreds," Bumper sniffed. "They're so hysterical."
She ignored the statement, looking round the clearing. It was an ideal spot for him, and she quickly unsaddled him, laying the saddle and bridle over a horizontal branch. She unstrung her bow, unclipped the quiver from her belt, and slid them both into the waterproof bow case attached to Bumper's saddle. She threw the blanket over his back and fastened the straps around his shoulders and under his belly. "That should keep you cozy," she told him. He looked at her sidelong, and she gestured to a narrow gap between the trees on the side of the glade farthest from the castle. "There's a stream through there, about 5 metres away," she said. They could hear the water bubbling and splashing cheerfully. "And I'll leave you some oats. Don't eat them all at once." Bumper snorted. Such an injunction was beneath his dignity. She poured half the oats into the bucket and set it under a tree for him. Bumper was trained to eat sparingly. She knew he wouldn't simply munch down the oats as soon as she was gone, and he would remain in the glade without needing to be tethered, except when he needed water. If there were any passers-by, he would stay silent and unmoving. She didn't like leaving him here when he could have been in Warwick's warm barn, but there was no alternative. "I'll be back tomorrow night," she told him. She and Warwick had discussed her plan to keep watch at the abbey, and they both agreed that it was unlikely the foxes would gather there tonight, so soon after they had been there. Previously, signs of activity at the abbey had been at least 5 or 6 days apart, so it would likely be close to a week before they reconvened. But to be on the safe side, she would begin watching the following night.
"I'll take a quick look up there tonight, just to make sure," Warwick told her,
and she had agreed to that. She patted Bumper's neck, and he bumped his head against her shoulder affectionately. Then she slipped back through the trees, untied Sundancer's bridle, and swung up into the saddle. "Stay out of sight," she called back to Bumper, and he whinnied briefly, which she took as,
"Tell me something I don't know."
Then she touched her heels to Sundancer and trotted out of the trees and onto the open parkland. Once on clear ground, she touched him again and set him to a fast canter up the hill. He wasn't Bumper, she thought, but he was an excellent horse. He had a smooth, easy gait and an exceptional turn of speed. She increased the pace to a gallop and he stretched out, covering the ground in long, easy strides, his hooves barely seeming to touch the ground. As she came closer to the castle, she saw her mother, mounted on her black gelding, waiting outside the walls at the end of the drawbridge. Diamond and another rider were with her, standing a few metres away. She reined in beside her mother, Sundancer scattering tufts of grass and clumps of mud as she did so. She laughed with the sheer exhilaration of the dash up the hill. Cassandra glanced meaningfully at the sun, almost overhead. You're nearly late, she said. Maddie grinned at her, which means I'm on time, or even a little early, she replied. Cassandra shrugged, then turned as a stable boy led a string of 3 ponies across the drawbridge, and handed the lead rein to Diamond's companion. All of the ponies were saddled, and, she noticed, all of them were quite elderly and docile. The young captain saw Maddie's curious gaze and gestured to the horses. "They're for the Scandians," Diamond told her, answering her unasked question. "Couldn't we find them something a little more lively?" she asked. One of them, a dappled grey, looked in danger of falling asleep in mid-stride. Her mother answered her. "Scandians aren't keen riders," she said. "They'll ride when they have to, but they'd rather not." "You're coming with us?" Maddie asked Diamond. He nodded. "Of course. I can't let the princess ride off without protection, although I'd rather have a half-troop." "Two of you will be enough," Cassandra said easily. "After all, I'm armed." She tapped the polished wood hilt of the katana in her belt. "And Maddie and I both have our slings." Like her daughter, Cassandra always carried her sling and a pouch of shot with her when she travelled anywhere. She paused for a second to make sure the trooper had the horses ready to move, then pointed to the northeast, the direction where the River Semeth lay. "Let's get moving," she said. They proceeded at a gentle trot, the best pace the 3 tubby old ponies could manage, Maddie assumed. Halfway down the slope, they angled to the east. They rode into the trees, following a wide bridle path. After 15 minutes, the trees began to thin out, until they were riding on a clear grassy area, with only occasional growths. The river gleamed silver in the middle distance. It was wide and slow-flowing at this point. From here, it wound down to the coast, some 15 kilometres away. Inland, it cut back to the south, emerging by the picturesque village that lived under Castle Araluen's protection, then disappearing into the wooded flatlands that lay in that direction. They reined in at the sturdy wooden jetty on the banks of the river. Cassandra stood in her stirrups, shading her eyes as she peered downstream. Half a kilometre away from their vantage point, there was a sharp bend in the river. As yet, there was no sign of the wolf ship. Maddie assumed the Scandians would be in a wolf ship. "There she is," Diamond said, pointing. A small, graceful craft was rounding the bend, travelling at a considerable speed, in spite of the light wind. Maddie was surprised to see that it wasn't a wolf ship, at least not one like any that she had seen in pictures. It was smaller than she expected, with 4 oars on each side instead of the normal 10 to 15, and the sail was a triangular shape, set along the line of the hull, instead of a square sail set crosswise. As she watched, the ship reached the northern bank of the river and turned to the left to tack toward them. As its bow came round, she was surprised to see the triangular sail lose its taut shape and slide down the stumpy mast. In its place, another sail slid up on the downwind side, caught the wind, and filled into a smooth, swelling shape. The ship, which had lost a little speed in the turn, accelerated once more, a distinctive white bow wave forming under its forefoot. A long banner rippled out from the tall sternpost, and Maddie frowned. The device on the banner was a red hawk, stooping after its prey. "That's your banner," she said, slightly scandalized. To her surprise, her mother grinned. "Yes. Arik flew that banner on Wolfwind when he brought Will and Hort and me home. And Hal has continued the tradition, flying it from the Heron whenever he visits. They're a cheeky bunch," she added with a smile. She didn't appear to mind that her personal insignia was being usurped. "How?" Maddie asked. She knew who Arik was. After all, he was the Oberjarl, the ruler of the Scandians. Everyone knew who he was. "Hal Mikkelsen. He's one of their most successful skippers. Skirls, they call them. A brilliant navigator and shipbuilder. He designed that ship. Gillen sailed in it with them when they flushed out a band of assassins who were targeting me some years back." Maddie wrinkled her nose. "It's kind of small, isn't it?" "It's small, but according to Gillen, it's very fast and amazingly manoeuvrable. Something to do with the shape of the sail." Diamond was watching the fast-approaching ship with interest. "So this is the famous Heron Brother Band," he said, almost to himself. "What's a brother band?" Maddie asked. "And how come this one's famous?"
"The Scandians train their young men in groups of 10 or 12, Diamond said. "They learn to live together, fight together, and handle their ships. A brother band becomes the basis of a ship's crew when they graduate. They stay together for life."
"And this one is famous," Cassandra chipped in, "because they've travelled from one end of the known Earth to the other. They pursued a pirate named Zavak down the Dan River to the eastern end of the Constant Sea. He'd stolen a precious artifact from Hallesholm, their capital. They caught up with him, sank his ship, and killed him. After that, they fought and defeated the assassin cult I mentioned in the eastern part of Arida. And they rescued a group of young Araluans who were taken by slavers in Socorro. They're even rumoured to have discovered a new land way to the west. But that's probably a myth," Diamond put in. Maddie noticed a slightly dismissive note in his voice as he made the last comment, almost as if he was reluctant to sing the Scandians' praises too enthusiastically. Maddie turned her gaze back to the pretty little ship that was drawing up to the jetty. She heard a command shouted from the stern, and the sail suddenly collapsed and slid down the mast, crewmen hurrying to gather it in. The ship turned slightly to run parallel to the jetty, speed falling off her. She had almost stopped as she reached the structure. A tall figure leapt lightly ashore and passed a hawser round a bollard, looping it twice round the worn timber for purchase. He set his heels and slowly brought the ship to a halt. The bow swung in against the jetty, the impact absorbed by cane fenders that were hanging over the sides of the ship. Another crewman jumped ashore to do the same thing at the stern end. In the space of half a minute, the ship was secured snugly to the jetty. "Come on," Cassandra said, grinning widely. "Let's go say hello." She slipped down from the saddle and strode toward the jetty. Maddie hastened to follow her. Behind them, Diamond paused uncertainly, then turned to his trooper. "Mind the horses," he said, and dismounted, hurrying to catch up with the two women.
"Stig!" Cassandra cried, holding out her arms to embrace the tall Scandian who had jumped ashore first. "Welcome to Araluin!"
He engulfed her in an enthusiastic bear hug, lifting her off her feet. Diamond started forward, then stopped as he heard Cassandra's delighted peal of laughter.
"Put me down, you great ape," she said.
Eventually, the Scandian did, and she turned to beckon Maddie forward.
"Stig, this is my daughter Maddie. Maddie, this is Stig."
Maddie studied him with interest. He was tall and broad-shouldered and athletic in build. He reminded her of her father in the way he moved, gracefully and always in balance. He was handsome, there was no denying it, with sparkling blue eyes, even features, and a short, neatly trimmed blonde beard and moustache. His hair was blonde as well,
and cut short. He shook her hand, grinning as he saw her wary reaction. She wasn't sure that he mightn't envelop her in a bear hug as well, although, on reflection, she thought that mightn't be altogether too unpleasant.
Cassandra continued with introductions.
"Stig, this is Diamond, captain of my guard."
The Scandian stepped forward, smiling and offering his hand.
Maddie was somewhat surprised to see Diamond hesitate momentarily, then take it.
She put it down to his overprotective attitude toward her mother.
"Good to meet you," Stig said cheerfully.
Diamond replied a little stiffly, "Welcome to Araluen."
Maddie had no further time to reflect on Diamond's awkwardness. Her mother was drawing her attention to two more of the Scandians, who were advancing up the jetty, their faces wreathed in smiles. "And here are two more old friends, Hal Mickelson, Skirl of the Heron, and Thorn, the biggest rascal you're ever likely to meet."
24. At the last moment, Gillen changed his point of aim. Somehow, it went against the grain to kill an unarmed, unsuspecting man, even an enemy. However, the swimmer had to be stopped, and the target area he offered was small. Only his head and shoulders showed above the surface of the river. Gillen selected his right shoulder as an aiming point and released. He heard the other four bows shoot almost at the same time, following his lead. His arrow plunged down in a shallow arc and struck the lead swimmer in the right shoulder. The man let out a cry of agony and stopped swimming. Almost immediately, he sank beneath the water, only to surface again a meter downstream, churning the water to foam with his left arm and crying out in pain. His comrades on the riverbank stared at him in panic for a few seconds. Then, as his cries continued, they began to haul in on the rope, dragging him back toward the bank. He turned on his back in the water, feebly kicking with his feet, thrashing the surface, in an attempt to get back to the bank. The other archers didn't have the luxury of choosing to wound their targets. Gillen was a superlative shot, and he could aim at the swimmer's shoulder with confidence. His companions couldn't hope for that sort of accuracy, and the swimming men offered them only small targets. One of them was hit in the chest, the arrow plunging through the water almost unimpeded to strike him 20 centimeters below the surface. He cried out once, threw up his hands, and sank without a further sound. The rope handlers hauled on his rope, and he reappeared after a few meters, lying on his back, limp and unmoving, as they pulled him back to the bank. The third swimmer yelled out in fear as three arrows whipped viciously into the water around him. One of them was close enough to graze his arm with its razor-sharp warhead, and blood started reddening the water around him. In response to his frantic cries, his companions began dragging him back through the water as fast as they could. A sizable wave built up around him as the current ran over his fast-moving body. Inevitably, some of it went into his mouth, and he began coughing and gagging. "Stop shooting," Gillen ordered quietly. "Stand down." There was no point in wasting further arrows. The swimmers had been turned back, and once again the enemy were in disarray. The men tending the ropes shouted to their comrades to cover them with their shields, a request their friends weren't overly keen on fulfilling, since they planned to stay protected by the shields themselves. Seeing an opportunity to demoralize the men further, Gillen loosed an arrow at the group on the bank, targeting one of the rope handlers. The arrow hit him in the leg and he fell awkwardly to the grass, clasping both hands to the wound and appealing to his friends for help. They ignored him,
working harder to drag the injured swimmer to the bank. As he rolled into the shallows, two of them dashed forward and, grabbing him by the arms, began to drag him backward toward the tree line, heedless of his cries of pain. The second swimmer, hit in the chest, was obviously dead when he grounded in the shallows. He made no move to rise, and his arms and legs moved weakly in the current. His rope handlers, after a moment's hesitation, cut the rope attached to him and ran for the trees, one of them pausing to assist the man with the leg wound. The current continued to move the dead swimmer until he gradually drifted away from the bank and downriver. He rolled over once so that he was floating face down. Then he was lost to sight as the river took him round a slight curve. The third swimmer, blood flowing down his arm, scrambled to his feet as he reached the shallows and splashed ashore. He wasted no time on his friends, setting out at a dead run for the safety of the trees. The rope trailed behind him, snaking through the long grass. Gillen sent an arrow hissing past his ears to speed him along. Surprisingly, the man found extra reserves of speed and redoubled his efforts to reach safety. Then the inevitable happened. The trailing rope snagged round a low tree stump and jerked tight, bringing him crashing to the ground. He rolled around frantically, yelling in fear and thrashing at the ground as he sought to cast the rope loose. Then, finally free, he lurched to his feet and took off again. The watching archers chuckled. Gillen narrowed his eyes, scanning the rope-handling party still on the far bank. Huddled behind their shields, they began to retreat slowly away from the river. He could see that they had no idea where the sudden hail of arrows had come from. None of them was looking at the row of bushes. They were all scanning the river bank directly opposite them. He gave them a few more minutes as they retreated cautiously. As before, when no sudden hail of arrows eventuated, their confidence grew and they stood more upright, still with the shields in front of them as they backed away and began to move faster.
"Walt, Gilbert, get going," Gillen said. "Stay low and keep these bushes between you and them. When you reach your horses, walk them for the first 20 meters. Don't suddenly gallop away, or you'll be heard."
The two archers grunted their understanding and, staying in a crouch, duck-walked on their haunches away from the bushes, staying low until they were inside the tree line. Once he was assured they were on their way, Gillen resumed his watch on the far bank. The enemy were milling around the two injured swimmers, now that they had assisted them back to the tree line. The one Gillen had shot looked to be in a bad way. They laid him on the ground, and he could see several medical orderlies bringing a litter for him. As before, their leader raged impotently. But after several minutes, sensing the silent animosity of his men, he moderated his behaviour, trying to be more conciliatory. Nestor, the senior archer, moved up alongside Gillen to watch and chuckled quietly.
"Think they'll try again, Ranger?" he asked.
Gillen shrugged. "I don't know how they'd go about it. They're sitting ducks once they get into the water, and they know it. He'll have a hard time persuading them to try it again. The only thing I can think of is for them to try to cross wearing armour."
"They'll sink if they do,"
Nestor replied. Gillen shrugged. "Maybe a heavy breastplate and helmet might keep a man on his feet," he said. "If they can stop being swept away, it might give them a chance." Nestor patted his quiver, where the feathered ends of his arrows rustled as he touched them. He withdrew one, fitted with a hardened, tapering bodkin point.
"That is, until we put one of these beauties through his breastplate," he said.
Bodkin arrows were designed to penetrate armour. The archers carried a mixed selection of bodkins and leaf-shaped barbed warheads in their quivers. True, Gillen agreed. They may not know we have armour-piercing arrows. We haven't used them so far.
Be another nasty shock for them, won't it?
Nestor said. He sounded as if he was very pleased with the idea of surprising the enemy yet again. Gillen continued to watch the foxes. Now that the first flurry of activity looking after the injured swimmers had passed, they appeared to be having an animated discussion. Faintly, the ranger could hear shouted comments and voices raised in anger, although he couldn't make out the words themselves. Whatever they were discussing, it was going to be a while before they could organize a further attempt on the ford. Nestor, he said, you and Cleet might as well get going. Remember, stay low until you're in the trees, then move off slowly once you're mounted. Nestor sniffed.
Happy to stay here with you if you like, Ranger, he said.
Gillen grinned at him. The old war horse was enjoying this, he thought, but he waved him away. I appreciate the offer, but you'd better be on your way. I can hold the fort here for a while longer.
That's true enough,
Nestor agreed. He had no misconceptions about Gillen's skill. He knew the ranger was a better shot, a far better shot, than himself or any of his men. And Gillen was fast. He could send a hail of arrows, all aimed shots, whistling through the air at the enemy, making them think they were facing three or four shooters.
All right, Cleet, Nestor said, turning to the other archer. Let's make a move. Stay low now.
Like the others, they crept out of the bushes while doubled down on their haunches to stay concealed. Gillen watched them go, then looked back to the foxes. They were still debating, still moving around uncertainly. There would be no further threat from them for some time, he thought. He settled down to wait, wondering what they would try next. When they did make a move, his earlier prediction, spoken half in jest, turned out to be correct. A group of five men, huddled behind hastily constructed wooden, man-high shields, advanced on the river bank. Among them was a man wearing a helmet and metal breastplate, and carrying a smaller, circular shield. He was a squat, stocky figure, made even more so by the fact that he was wearing the armour. Gillen assumed that there was a layer of chainmail underneath the breastplate. He selected a bodkin point arrow from his quiver and waited. The small group stopped a few metres from the riverbank. Hastily, one of them wound the end of a rope around the armoured man's waist, tied it off, then retreated behind the makeshift shield wall. Another stayed beside the would-be crosser, protecting him with a long shield. The shield-bearer walked with him to the water's edge, scanning the far bank anxiously, trying to see some sign of movement, some indication that they were about to be shot at. Then, as the armoured man slipped into the river and waded quickly forward until he was waist-deep, the shield-bearer skipped back to the relative safety of the shield wall behind him. The armoured man now raised the small shield he carried, so that it covered his head and upper body. He steadied himself, testing the strength of the current as it pushed at him, then took a tentative few steps forward. It appeared that Gillen's supposition had been correct. The weight of the armour and helmet helped stabilise him against the fierce tug of the current. But that was somewhat offset by the uneven nature of the riverbed. Three times in the first 10 metres, he had to stop to regain his balance as the river threatened to topple him. Then he continued, walking slowly, testing each step. "Mind how you go," Gillen said softly. "If you fall, they're going to have to drag you out in a hurry." 3 more paces. The man swayed, then recovered. He advanced farther. He was now a third of the way across the river, the shield held up in front of his face and upper body. Gillen nodded in admiration. This was a brave man, he thought. He was also an intelligent one. Unlike those who had gone before him, he wasn't growing overconfident when there was no sign of opposition. He continued to move deliberately, expecting a volley of arrows at any minute. Halfway across, still he continued his steady, patient progress. Occasionally, as his footing became uneven, the shield would dip momentarily as he regained his balance. But it was impossible for Gillen to predict when this would happen, and there was never enough time to release a shot while the shield was down. He recovered quickly each time. 3/4 of the way. The river began to shallow at this point, and he crouched, staying low so that the water reached almost to his neck, with the circular shield protecting his exposed face and shoulders. On the far side, his companions shouted encouragement as they saw him wading closer and closer to the bank without any sign of resistance. Back in the trees, the rest of the foxes joined in the chorus of support, cheering and whistling. He was in the shallows now, still crouching behind the cover of the shield. Gillen selected a second arrow from his quiver, holding it loosely between the fingers of his bow hand. Then, rising to his feet, he aimed and shot. The armored man was wading up the bank, water cascading from him, draining out of the metal breastplate. He stayed low, with the shield held protectively before him, until Gillen's first arrow hit it and knocked it sideways. The second shot was already on its way while the first was in the air. As quickly as the man tried to recover, bringing his shield back in front of his body, the arrow was even quicker. It slammed into the unprotected breastplate with the full force of Gillen's massive bow behind it. At such a short range, the armor had no chance against the hardened steel point. It ripped through the breastplate and into the man's body. He reeled back into the shallow water. As it reached up to his calves, it tripped him, and he toppled backward into the shallows. The shouts of encouragement from the far bank fell silent as the foxes watched their comrade lying still in the river. Gillen studied him carefully. He was weighed down by the breastplate, helmet, and shield. The current didn't seem to be moving him as it had moved the previous crossers. There was always the chance that he might be heavy enough to anchor the rope on this side and allow another swimmer to cross. Coming to a decision, Gillen loosed a volley of 6 arrows at the men on the opposite bank. The arrows rained down in rapid succession, thudding into shields and exposed limbs. It was too much for the men to bear. They had been lashed by these arrow storms twice before, and now they simply broke and ran. Knowing that all eyes would be on them for a few minutes, Gillen slipped around the end of the line of bushes and sprinted for the river bank, drawing his sacks as he went. He stooped over the body of the armored man and quickly slashed the loop of rope around his upper body. The loose end of the rope floated away in the current. Satisfied, Gillen turned and ran back to the bushes. He'd wait a while longer, then head out after Horace and the rest of the party. It would be some time, he thought, before the foxes attempted another crossing. 25. Hal Mickelson was a distinct contrast to his crewman, Stig. He was slighter in build and not as tall, although he was well-muscled and fit.
His hair was light brown, worn long, and tied back from his face in a neat queue. He was clean-shaven, and, Maddie noticed with interest, very handsome. His brown eyes were friendly, as he reached to take her hand. "Princess Madeline," he said, and she took his hand. His eyes showed slight surprise for a second as he felt her firm grip. "Call me Maddie," she said. He nodded, pleased with her lack of formality. Scandians didn't go in for that sort of thing. She heard Diamond clear his throat, a disapproving sound. She assumed it was because of Hal's casual approach. The Skirl, as she now knew him to be, turned to Cassandra, a wide grin on his face. He relinquished Maddie's hand and stepped forward to embrace her mother. Again, Diamond shifted his feet awkwardly. "Cassandra," Hal said, "it's good to see you again." "And you, Hal, it's been too long," Cassandra said. When she was free from Hal's embrace, she touched Maddie's arm lightly and indicated the third Scandian. "This is Thorn," she said, pausing before adding, "I'm not sure if I ever heard your second name, Thorn." Thorn was unlike anyone Maddie had ever met. He was older than the other two, tall and heavily built, bear-like, she thought, though the bulk was all muscle, not fat. His iron-grey hair grew in wild tangles, and he had it set in two loose plaits. His beard and moustache were equally unkempt. His moustache, in fact, was uneven, one side being longer than the other by several centimetres. This was because a few days prior, working on tiring a seam on the ship's deck, he had inadvertently gotten a large dollop of tar on the right side of his moustache. Unable to clean it off, he had simply taken his sacks and removed the offending section. Thorn was dressed in the leggings and sealskin boots that Scandian sailors habitually wore, and his upper body was covered by an amazing sheepskin vest. At least, Maddie thought it might have been sheepskin originally. Now it was covered with variegated patches, sewn on haphazardly wherever they were needed. Studying him, Maddie thought there might be more patches than original garment. His eyes were blue and had a far-seeing look to them. He seemed to view the world with a constant sense of amusement, and she found herself instinctively liking him. But the most notable feature of the man was his right hand, or rather the lack of it. His arm ended halfway down the forearm, and the hand had been replaced with a polished wooden hook. He brandished it now in answer to Cassandra's implied question.
"It's Thorn Hooky Hand, your royalty," he told her, grinning hugely.
Thorn's disregard for protocol and royal titles was even stronger than that of most Scandians.
"Actually, he's usually known as Thorn Hammerhand," Stig told them.
Maddie frowned. The wooden hook was substantial, but it didn't look at all like a hammer.
"Hammerhand?" she queried.
Stig explained.
"When we go into battle, he changes the hook for a huge club that Hal made for him. It fits over the end of his arm, and he can smash helmets, shields, and armor with it."
His grin widened.
"He's terrible in battle."
"He's terrible any time," Hal interposed, and all three Scandians and Cassandra laughed heartily. Hal indicated the ship moored a few meters away.
"Come and meet the rest of the crew," he said, adding to Cassandra, "They'll be pleased to see you again, Princess."
They crossed the jetty to the little ship, Hal assisting Cassandra down onto the bulwark and then the deck. Stig held out his hand to Maddie, but she didn't notice, negotiating the gap from the jetty to ship's railing easily. then stepping down lightly onto the deck. Thorn eyed her astutely. She wasn't the usual simpering, giggling princess that you might expect, he thought. But then, of course, she was Cassandra's daughter. Like her mother, she was slim and moved with an easy athleticism. Aside from a slight limp, he noticed. His keen eyes noted the sling coiled neatly under her belt and the pouch of lead shot. He also noticed that she had a sheathed sax at her side. Hardly the sort of thing one would expect a young woman at court to be carrying. Altogether, a fascinating character. As she met the other members of the crew and chatted with them, Thor noted her easy confidence and self-assurance. She wasn't daunted or overawed in the presence of this group of capable, tough men. She seemed quite at home in their presence, in fact. He also noted that the Herons seemed to react well to her, treating her as an equal, albeit one to be respected. "There's more to this one than meets the eye," he thought. Cassandra was looking round the ship, a slightly puzzled expression on her face. "Where's Lydia? Is she no longer with you?" Stig offered a sad smile. "She's still a Heron," he told her. "But Agith, the old woman who took her in when she first came to Hallisholm, is very ill. Agith's been like a surrogate mother to Lydia since she's been with us. The healers don't give her a lot of time, and Lydia thought she should stay with her this time, instead of coming on this trip." "More's the pity," said the huge man who wore strange dark patches of tortoise shell over his eyes. He'd been introduced as Ingvar. "We all miss her." Cassandra turned to her daughter, her disappointment obvious. "That's a shame. I really wanted you to meet her. She's an amazing woman, just as much a warrior as any of this lot." She made an all-encompassing gesture that took in the rest of the crew. Her smile robbed the words of any insult, and several of them grunted assent. Thorn frowned thoughtfully. Why would Cassandra be so keen to have her daughter meet a girl warrior like Lydia? He looked at Maddie again. Ingvar had taken her forearm and was showing her the workings of the mangler. The massive crossbow that Heron had mounted in her bows. The young woman was studying the weapon with what appeared to be professional interest.
"There's definitely more to her than meets the eye," he told himself for the second time. Cassandra led the way back to the jetty, Stig, Hal and Thorn following her as she stepped ashore.
Maddie smiled a farewell to Ingvar. The dark tortoiseshell covers over his eyes were disconcerting at first, but once you became used to them, he was a likable character. "I've organized a luncheon in the park outside the castle," Cassandra said as she led the way to the horses. She stopped and turned back, looking at the ship. "The whole crew are welcome to join us, of course." Hal shook his head. "Kind of you, but the lads can stay here. We hit a storm on the way over, and there are a few repairs that have to be done. Ropes spliced and rigging replaced." "I'll have food brought down to the ship, in that case," Cassandra said.
"Lots of it," Ingvar called, and they all laughed.
They mounted the horses. Hal and Stig seemed reasonably comfortable riding. Thorn showed a little more trepidation. He held the reins tightly in his left hand, looking warily at the sleepy horse he had been given. "You don't like riding?" Maddie asked with a grin.
"If it doesn't have a rudder and a tiller, I don't trust it," the shaggy old sea wolf replied. "Besides, I can never find the anchor on one of these when I want to stop it moving."
"You'll have a bigger problem starting that one moving," Maddie told him. He was riding the horse that had looked as if it could fall asleep in mid-stride.
"That suits me fine,"
Thorn replied between clenched teeth. Normally, the Araluans would have cantered easily back up the hill to the castle. Out of deference to their guests, they maintained a stately walk.
"Heron looks in good shape," Cassandra said to Hal.
He smiled a little sadly.
"Yes, but she takes a lot of maintenance these days. She's feeling her age, I'm afraid. I suppose I'll have to build a new ship one of these days, but I can't bear the idea of parting with her. This may be her last voyage."
"Speaking of which, what brings you here this time? The message I got said it was something to do with the archers we send you." In a treaty arranged by Will many years before, Araluin sent a force of 100 archers to Scandia each year to help protect them against the threat of the Temujai riders. In return, Arik provided a wolf ship for the king's use, in carrying messages and helping suppress smuggling and piracy along the coast. Another part of the treaty had been Arik's agreement to stop raiding the Araluin coast. Arik was wondering if we could increase the number of archers this year, Hal told her. Another 20 men would be welcome. Cassandra raised her eyebrows.
"Shouldn't be a problem," she said.
"Are you expecting trouble of some kind?" Hal's horse stumbled slightly over a protruding tree root. He instantly dropped the reins and gripped the pommel of his saddle in both hands. Cassandra smiled and gave him a few minutes to recover the reins and his equanimity.
"He's got 4 feet. Why can't he stay on an even keel?" Hal asked.
"Hugh Scandians fascinate me," Cassandra said. "You can walk around quite calmly on a ship heaving and plunging through 4-meter waves for hours on end. But if a horse so much as sneezes, you think you're in danger of falling off."
"You can trust a ship," Hal told her.
"Horses can turn nasty, and they bite." He added the last darkly. Maddie, listening, wondered if there was a story behind that particular statement. "But to answer your question," Hal continued, "we're a little concerned about the Temujai. They've been sniffing around the border in the past few months, and Arik thinks they might be planning something. Their Shashan has never forgiven us for taking him prisoner years ago." Cassandra looked at him with interest.
"I didn't know about that."
Hal grinned. "It's quite a story," he said. "Kept them quiet for some time, but now they're getting restless again, and Arik would like to beef up the archers' numbers. He's offering you an extra supply of timber and hides in exchange. I'm authorized to negotiate the amounts."
"I'm sure we can sort out the details," Cassandra said. "Although we may have to wait until Horus returns with the men he's taken."
It was Hal's turn to look disappointed.
"Horus isn't here."
She shook her head. "He's gone north, chasing down a bunch of nuisances called the Red Fox Clan," she said. "He should be back within 10 days or so."
"Pity," Hal said.
"We'll probably be gone by then.
By the way," he added, "when we rounded Cape Shelter a few weeks back, we sighted a Sonderland ship crammed with soldiers and heading south. They haven't bothered you, have they?"
Cassandra shook her head.
"Not that I know of."
Diamond, riding behind them, answered the question.
"They were probably headed for Iberion," he said. "We had dinner with the ambassador this week, and he said they were hiring Sonderland mercenaries to put down a revolt in one of their provinces."
Hal nodded. "No problem for you, then," he said.
"In any event, once we've agreed on the changes to the treaty and restocked the ship with provisions, we'll head back to Scandia."
"Speaking of provisions," Cassandra told him, "we've planned a hunt for tomorrow, There are plenty of deer in the forest, and quite a few boar, and the lake is full of geese and ducks. That'll make Edwin happy. He's always keen to replenish our stocks of fresh meat whenever he can. It'll make Ingvar happy too, Stig put in. He's always keen to eat it.
26. Once he was away from the immediate vicinity of the river bank, Gillen urged Blaze into a steady canter. By the time he caught up with the rest of the party, they were a few hundred metres from the old hill fort. "Any developments back at the ford?" Horace asked as Gillen rode up and drew rein beside him. "Nothing unexpected. Three of them tried to cross, and we beat them back. That set them to thinking for a while, as they realized how vulnerable they were once they were in the river. Then they sent one man wearing armour to try to get a rope across. He made it to the bank, but got no farther."
"You shot him?" Horace said.
Gillen regarded him with an even gaze. "Well, I didn't walk down and hand him a bunch of jonquils." "What do you think they'll do next?" Gillen paused. He'd been considering that while he was riding to catch up with a mixed force of cavalry and archers. "I think they'll wait for nightfall," he said. "It'd be harder to pick them off in the dark."
Horace glanced at the sun, already dipping below the treetops to the west.
"That gives us another hour, at least," he said. "What time is moonrise tonight?"
"Somewhere between the sixth and seventh hour, I think. That'll delay them even further. The moon would give us plenty of light to shoot by."
"If you were still there to shoot at them," Horace said.
Gillen nodded.
"If we were still there to shoot at them," he agreed. Then he gestured toward the ancient structure looming before them. "Let's take a look at this hill fort." As the name suggested, the fort had been built on the site of a natural feature, a low but steep-sided hill. A path spiralled around the hill, leading up to the summit, where a wooden structure had been built, a palisade of logs 2 meters high. There would be a walkway constructed inside it for the defenders. The sides of the hill were covered with long grass, making the hill difficult to climb, especially for men burdened with armour and weapons. Gillen had a mental picture of men slipping and stumbling as they tried to battle their way upward. They'd be badly exposed to arrows, spears, rocks, and other missiles from the fortifications at the top. Horace gave the order for the archers and troopers to remain at the base while he and Gillen climbed the hill to survey the fort. He sent 2 troopers back down the path that led to the river to give early warning if the Red Fox clan had managed to cross in pursuit. Then he and Gillen urged their horses up the narrow, winding path. Even on the path, the going was steep and difficult. The ground underfoot was packed earth, and the track followed the contours of the hill, spiralling upward. The path was 3 meters wide, and at irregular intervals there were barriers of rock and wood, designed to further delay an attacker's progress. Eventually, of course, an attacking force could outflank the stone and timber barriers across the path, but it would take time for them to do so. They dismounted at the first of these obstacles, and heaved the old rotting panel that served as a gate to one side.
"Should we man some of these?" Gillen asked.
Horace shook his head. "We don't have enough men. Better to hold the very top. Make the foxes climb all the way, then shove them back down." They rode on, circling round to the far side of the hill, then returning once more, always angling upward, and passing 2 more barricades as they did. They circled the hill 1 more time and came to the end of the track.
The very top of the hill had been dug out so that they were confronted by a sheer earth wall, 1.5 meters high, that ran all the way round the hilltop. Above that, the timber palisade stood 2 meters high. A heavy gate was set into it. They dismounted. Horace tethered his horse to a nearby bush, and they set about scrambling up the packed earth wall on their hands and knees. At their first attempt, they simply slid back down. Then Gillen drew his axe and drove it into the hard earth to provide a secure handhold. Horace did likewise, and they gained the upper level beneath the palisade. They studied the gate. The timber was old and warped, but it appeared solid. There was no sign of rot. "Good hardwood," Horace said appreciatively. "Lasts for years. That'll keep them out." "It appears to be doing the same to us," Gillen observed mildly. Horace looked around, seeking some other form of entrance, although he knew there wouldn't be one. Then he stepped close to the wooden wall, standing with his back to it, and held his hands cupped together at thigh height.
"Come on," he said. "I'll boost you up."
Gillen slung his bow around his shoulders, and slid his quiver around to the back of his belt. Then he took a few paces forward and stepped up into Horace's stirruped hands. As Gillen straightened his knee, Horace heaved upward, and their combined thrust propelled the ranger to the top of the wall. He hauled himself over the rough timbers, pausing with 1/2 of his body inside the wall, and the other outside, while he studied the wooden walkway running around the interior of the wall. It looked solid enough, so he rolled himself over the parapet and dropped lightly to the old planks.
"All okay," Horace called from below.
Gillen rose to peer over the top of the wooden wall, grinning.
"Fine," he said. "I'll slip down and raise the locking bar on the gate." "Watch your step," Horace cautioned him. "The timbers in there mightn't be as solid as the walls."
Gillen waved acknowledgement and made his way along the catwalk, to where he could see a flight of stairs leading down into the interior of the fort. He paused at the top to look around. The timber wall enclosed a circular area 20 meters in diameter. It wasn't a very large space, he thought, but it would be easier to defend with their small body of men. There were 3 large huts and 1 smaller one in the inner compound. They were constructed from timber and seemed the worse for wear. Originally, the roofs had been thatched, but the thatching had long since rotted away. The huts themselves, built from lighter timber than the fort, had deteriorated badly. They leaned and sagged precariously, looking as if 1 good push would send them crashing to the ground. He studied the steps for a few seconds, testing them with his weight, before he committed himself. The stairway moved slightly under his weight, and 2 of the risers groaned and creaked as he made his cautious way down to ground level. "Have to repair them," he muttered. But on the whole, he was relieved to see that the stairs were sound. Obviously, the defensive, utilitarian parts of the fort had been built to last, using solid hardwood. The accommodation huts were another matter. He hurried to the gate, where a heavy wooden bar was secured in 2 massive iron brackets. The brackets were rusted, but still sound. He lifted the bar and set it to 1 side. Then he laid hold of the handle on the door and heaved. It opened a crack. Then the old hinges screamed a protest, and it stopped moving.
"Give it a shove," he called to Horace.
He felt the tall warrior's weight pushing against the door and redoubled his own efforts to pull it open. Reluctantly, the hinges succumbed to their combined efforts, and the door groaned halfway open. Then it stopped completely. Needs a bit of oil, he said.
Horace stepped inside, his eyes darting around as he took in the interior of the fort.
Those huts have had it, he said, and Gillen nodded agreement.